Hello, and welcome to the extended Q&A for the Skift Airline Weekly webinar, Airlines and COVID-19. Thank you for listening to the replay of the webinar, which will continue to be on our website, airlineweekly.com. And thank you for submitting your questions to the website. We'll take a few minutes to answer some of the questions that came in. I'm Madhuni Krishnan, Airline Weekly editor, and I'm with Jay Shabbat, Airline Weekly co-founder and senior analyst. Jay, let's dive right into some of the questions that we got from the website. And let's start with the few that came in from a master's degree class in hospitality and tourism at New York University. Our first question is this. While this is clearly a massive crisis for airlines, are there any positives emerging in terms of insights, ideas, and future possibilities?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So just want to start off by emphasizing the gravity of this crisis. I think everybody's aware of it by now, but can't stress enough that this is just so much worse than anything the airline industry has ever experienced in its history, so much worse than 9/11, so much worse than the global financial crisis, and it's universal. There's no airline around the world that's spared. Are there any positives? Well, there's just no two ways about the fact. I mean, the world is going to be worse off because of this, and you can't really sugarcoat that in any way, shape, or form. We can talk about how when the industry eventually comes back to life, perhaps airlines will be in a better will take a different approach to risk management that maybe help them a little bit more in future crises. Again, that's only on the margins. There's nothing that you can do to prepare for something like this. One interesting question when the recovery comes is just how distressed airlines will be. Take an airline like Delta, for example, who was just so strong going into the crisis and now it's got a few months of survival cash. When this is all over, be it 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, whatever it is, are they going to be a sick airline, or are they going to be, with the help of federal aid perhaps, be able to come back in roughly a similar position that they were before? Maybe demand will bounce back very quickly. Maybe a lot of other positive trends will happen. At that point, there could be interesting opportunities for carriers that are better positioned than others. If I can't contrast, perhaps all the airlines that currently exist are just in terrible shape coming out of this, there might be some new opportunities for startup airlines. I'll use the example after 9/11, the incumbent U.S. airlines, and there were six kind of big legacy carriers at the time. They were all just so in such bad shape. Their costs were so bloated, and they were really very vulnerable. And what happened is it gave a great opportunity for startups like JetBlue, which had just launched, not that long before 9/11. And even a carrier like Alaska that had been around longer, but was relatively small, relatively niche, they were able to capitalize on those opportunities. So you will see stuff like that when the recovery comes, opportunities for people with new ideas. Now, what those opportunities are, we don't know, because we don't know what fuel prices will be. We don't know what aircraft prices will be. We don't know what demand conditions will be. But it's the industry will change, and there will be different carriers in different positions and opportunities and threats that may look different than they did before the crisis. That was a good question. Do we have another?
Yeah, here's another one from the students at NYU. Which countries do we expect to see in terms of inbound and outbound travel to recover first?
So right now, it does look like China and perhaps even some neighboring countries are showing some faint signs of recovery, and maybe they'll lead us out of this mess. Now, it's important not to overstate that. The situation in China is such that several leasing companies and others have reported that there are indeed more planes in the air than there were at the trough in mid-February. There are perhaps some more passengers flying on those planes. However, we don't have a whole lot of data yet on particularly anything after February. And we also have to remember that there are certain decrees by the government where, you know, the government will say to the airlines that you have to get these planes back in the air again, or we strongly encourage you to do that with some financial incentives. And that may be the case with some passenger travel as well. There may be some industries that are heavily subsidized right now as part of a stimulus program where people are being encouraged to travel. We just don't know. But as of right now, it looks like Asia may lead the way. We'll see if it does prove that this virus is perhaps less virulent in hotter, wetter climates. Maybe that means Brazil gets through this a little bit not as bad as some other carriers or some other regions. I mentioned Brazil just as an example, but we can talk about Africa, maybe Singapore. Singapore and the surrounding region, that remains to be seen. As of right now, we're talking on 24th Tuesday. It appears that the epicenter of this crisis has moved first from Wuhan in China to Milan in Italy and the northern region of Italy. Now it looks like it's sort of centered on Madrid and New York seem to be the two worst examples. I don't know if that means Europe and the U.S. will be latest to emerge. That all remains to be seen. We can move to the next question.
Sure. Another question from the students at NYU. What is the likelihood that frequent flyer miles and programs will be used to supplement airlines and the money they've lost? Will airlines look for prepayment on miles to give them some cash?
Yeah, another good question. Several airlines did use this avenue of opportunity to raise cash during the global financial crisis 10, 11 years ago. Frequent flyer programs can be an extremely lucrative asset with which to borrow against or with which to do deals with your credit card partner. That seems to be most prevalent in the United States because the U.S. Frequent flyer programs are just so large. There are other examples around the world. I mean, Air Canada has a big plan, and Chinese carriers have big plans, and European carriers have not nearly as big as the U.S. guys, but there are certain carriers around the world that have pretty big plans too. Qantas raises a lot of money from their frequent flyer plan, and even a smaller carrier like Virgin Australia. These are very valuable plans. They are monetizable. However, it does seem in this situation that airlines are not ready to rush to that. There are other things they'd rather do first. Right now, the big focus is on government aid. We need all the help we can get from governments because it's code red emergency, and we need the money now. We need the money fast. Beyond that, airlines are looking to cut costs really to the bone, and they are borrowing money just via direct loans and tapping credit lines. At some point, they could sell airplanes. So frequent flyer miles, it's there as an option, as a financing option. But it's probably pretty far down the list in terms of things that airlines will use to get their cash. Next question.
Sure. Our final question from the students at NYU. How might airlines alter their long-term business models or practices based on lessons learned from this current situation?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that in the first question where, you know, airlines will perhaps take a look at their risk management procedures, and they may, they will adjust their business models based on the new conditions that emerge after the industry recovers. It's almost better to ask the question of how government policies might evolve after this. Will governments learn a lesson from this or have a takeaway from this that we need to be prepared for another one of these and we won't have to go through so much political haggling the next time? We'll have a kind of a pre-packaged plan in place when this happens. I don't know. I mean, it was interesting after the bank bailouts of, you know, 28, 29, 20, that era. there was some new legislation that basically said, you know, if this happens again, we're going to do this. And it's all, you know, you never know what the next crisis is going to look like exactly. So it's hard to do. But that is something I encourage everyone to watch, what the details of these government policies are going to be, and if there's anything in it that sort of prepares for future crises of a similar nature. We really don't know what that's going to look like, but it's something that we're keeping a close eye on here, but what the government policy response is, and if it'll just be focused on what's going on right now, or perhaps looking ahead and what might happen in the future. Next question.
Sure. And these following questions come from listeners that were submitted to our website. First is, will the current situation be likely to shake the world of global alliances? And if so, how?
Yeah, another good question. Interestingly enough, even before the crisis, alliances were sort of in flux in the sense that carriers were moving back and forth and not, right? There were no really ironclad commitments that lasted over very long periods of time. You do have examples of that, but it was also very common for an airline like LATAM to say, yeah, we're happy to be a oneworld member, but we had a situation where Delta came along with a good deal and wanted to invest in us, and we couldn't stay with, we couldn't do the joint venture with American that we wanted to do because of some adverse court rulings. So we'll just switch. And in that case, they committed to leaving oneworld, the oneworld alliance. They didn't in fact join SkyTeam, I don't believe, but it is an example of how these alliances are not that kind of written in stone. We even, interestingly enough, when Delta purchased Virgin Atlantic, or purchased part of Virgin Atlantic in 2013, Virgin Atlantic never did join SkyTeam. So a lot of times, airlines who decide to leave one alliance will then just decide to be independent. Will not join another. And there are different reasons for that. One, they want to preserve their relationships with as many carriers as possible that they had before the switch. So yeah, alliances are definitely in flux for sure. And we can go to the next question.
Sure. This is another question submitted to the website by a listener. How much of a bailout is needed? And I presume, I'm editorializing here, I presume this listener meant globally. So that's probably a good place to start.
Yeah, so IATA's put the figure somewhere in the low hundreds of billions of dollars. This is a crisis that's affecting every single airline in every single market in every single country. So it's we're talking about very large sums of money, and it's really an existential question. The governments and the public just have to decide: do we still want an airline industry, a functioning airline industry? Because right now we don't have one at all, pretty much. So, this is not going to come cheap. Now in the US, the situation as of today, as we're speaking, the Congress and the White House are proposing, a giant, federal stimulus package that will probably almost assuredly will include airlines as beneficiaries in one shape or form. Now, exactly what that will look like, we're all kind of on pins and needles waiting to see. We're watching very closely. We kind of joke here at Airline Weekly, we've kind of become political reporters in the sense that we're often watching Capitol Hill more than sometimes we're watching what's going on in airports these days. But U.S. airlines, for their part, they say they need about, I believe the figure was $58 billion is what they're asking for. They prefer to have that sort of broken into some direct grants to meet their payroll, so that they don't have to fire people, don't have to lay off people. That money would not have to be paid back if airlines get their way. There are proposals to provide loans to airlines, or perhaps loan guarantees in which the government basically promises to pay back the loan if the airlines can't pay it back. So it just basically takes away risk, takes away all the risks for a lender, a private sector lender to come in and provide the money. So a lot of details that are still to be worked out, exactly how they get the money. And also in the mix of this conversation is what conditions will be attached. There are groups of people that don't want airlines to do stock buybacks anymore. They want to limit executive compensation. There's a proposal today in one of the bills that would force airlines to reduce their emissions by a certain amount over time. So different groups are going to use this, and understandably so, they're going to use this opportunity to try to insert different restrictions or behavioral changes upon the airlines. And some airlines themselves, a lot of these restrictions, they'll be totally fine with. Another open question is whether in one form of bailout, if you want to call it that, or one form of rescue, is where the government actually provides capital, but they have to take, but they're going to take an ownership position in the airlines. That's something that's being discussed even over in Europe. I know the British government is discussing that with British Airways, which is almost hard to fathom that we're even talking about that because British Airways was privatized long ago. But the state may step back in, not with the sense that they want to nationalize, but more in the sense of what happened with the banks and the auto companies in the United States in 2010, or I guess it was 2008, where the government came in, they provided all this capital to companies like AIG and Citigroup and General Motors and Fiat Chrysler. And in exchange, they got ownership stakes. And the government never had intention of exercising control or management influence. It was just a sort of guarantee or protect the taxpayer, sort of mitigate taxpayer risk. And ultimately what happened, interestingly enough, in most of those bailouts, I don't believe so much the autos, there have been different analyses done, but with the banks, taxpayers have actually made off really well with that. They wound up making a lot of money back to the treasury after the government wound up selling those stakes that they took. So it may be the way to go. I don't know if they'll take that direction, but we should find out pretty soon in the U.S. And then, of course, elsewhere, you'll see various different government measures, whether it be tax relief, airport charges lowered. There may be some. We've seen a lot of relaxation of regulations, for example, of slot rules and such. So government policy, that's where it's all out. That's where it's all at right now. That's where the attention is focused. We can move to the next one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out and how many constituencies get what they want. Because as you said, there are a lot of irons in the fire right now.
It's good to be a lobbyist right now. There's no unemployment line among lobbyists.
All right, let's move on to our last question from a listener. And this is a multi-part question, so I'm going to break it into two parts, Jay. And let's start with the first part, which this listener labeled as the recovery phase. They ask, can you elucidate about potential long-term impacts in decreased corporate demand due to video conferencing or teleworking adaptations? Isn't it reasonable to expect that business travel budgets will effectively be 50% less of what they were last year, and that corporations may hold budgets to that spend level for 2021?
Yeah, another great question. Video conferencing is something everybody's talking about right now because of the situation where everyone's working at home. It's something for decades now. Every time a new technology comes out, every time a new communication technology arises, people are always asking the question, well, will this mean that businesses don't have to travel anymore? You can go back to the fax machine and people said, oh, no, people can just send stuff over fax. Why do they need to travel in person? And they said the same thing about email. And then in the 2000s, the early 2000s, you had a lot of investment in video conferencing, companies like Cisco et cetera, thought that might be the future of business communications. And some of that did take hold, but it never really replaced business travel or even close to it. I mean, it may have, and some people argue that it winds up even increasing business travel because it just, you know, the more the world is connected, the more business is going to get done across borders and across, you know, different locations. So will this time be different? Of course, we're going through a unique situation right here. The technology of video conferencing is presumably getting a lot better. People are becoming more comfortable with it now after doing it. So it is, you know, it's possible that perhaps it catches on more than in the past. Will it replace business travel? Very, very hard to believe. There may be other forces that wind up reducing business travel that result in people doing more video conferencing. A good example is, you know, maybe visa restrictions just get, you know, extremely tight across borders because people are worried about the next epidemic, or, you know, maybe there's just less globalization, less trade. I mean, a lot of that started even before the crisis. Maybe that just goes into hyperdrive and there's just less business. Business becomes more local. That's all, that just remains to be seen. The, as far as, you know, the amount, it's very hard to say, you know, is going to be travel budgets cut 50%. Right now they're, you know, mostly pretty much we're at a big zero for that right now. Nobody's traveling with, you know, maybe minor exceptions. Maybe there's some government travel or medical industry researchers, things like that. But there's virtually nothing right now. Will it eventually bounce back? My guess is yes. And we can all hope so. And next question.
Well, before we move on to the second part of our listener's question, I think we might have to explain to some of our younger listeners, including the students from NYU, what a fax machine is. But maybe that's a subject for another Q&A. All right. The second part of our listener's question is this. Demand recovery from 9/11, the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, was largely due to a concerted effort by airlines to prove to travelers that travel was safe. What do you think will be the key to convincing travelers to fly again after COVID-19? Is it aircraft or airport cleanliness?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. Airlines will make an effort to reassure their passengers that flying is safe and that their health won't be affected. They'll, I'm sure, invest in that message, no doubt. Ultimately, though, the history is that people very quickly bounce back after something, maybe not exactly like this, but certainly we've had episodes of terrorism and we've had health scares also, like SARS and 9/11, SARS and H1N1 and MERS. And what happens is there's a period of time when people are a bit reluctant, but that usually goes away way quickly. Same thing with even aircraft crashes. That's something that usually doesn't hold demand back for that long. The final thing I'll say in response to this question is that there surely is a lot of pent-up demand out there with just people sitting in their homes and unable to see relatives, unable to take vacations. It's hard to believe there won't be just a big snapback, a big rush to get to travel again when this is all over. Of course, people have to be reassured that it's safe naturally. But when we get back to some kind of new normal, that's the demand will most likely be there. I'll even leave with an anecdote. My mom was telling me just the other day that as soon as she can, when this craziness is all over, she wants to get back on a plane and come visit Florida. So there you go. I should also add that there is another question that someone submitted here, and it's a very good one. The question is, I'll read it. Who is cooler, Jay or Madhu? That one, I think there's an easy answer to. I think there's no two ways about that.
Well, the answer is Jay.
No, that's, I think everyone would agree that it's Jay, but perhaps we can have a, we know what, Madhu, maybe we can have a vote on that.
Yeah, I beg to differ, and I know which way the vote should go. So if you have any feedback on that last crucial question or anything else we discussed today, you can email me at mu@skift.com. And I want to thank everyone who submitted questions through our website to the webinar that we aired last week. Thank you and goodbye. Thank everyone who submitted questions through our website